Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Sending in for Andrew Tuck this week, I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on today's program.
If we're doing it for the right reasons, which is the long-term health and well-being of our residents, I think it's defensible change.
We meet the mayor of Victoria, who's pursuing an ambitious transport agenda. And we sit down with the mayor of Clarkston, who's been welcoming foreigners with open arms. And we ask if a new project by the studio behind New York's High Line can really change London. All that coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to this week's programme. Victoria on Vancouver Island is the provincial capital city of British Columbia, Canada's westernmost province. And like other government towns around the world, it has perhaps unfairly been labelled as slightly boring. It's a tag that couldn't be further from the truth, according to Victoria's mayor, Lisa Helps. She points to Victoria's soaring population, fueled in some part by the rising cost of living in nearby Vancouver, to a flourishing tech economy and to a novel approach to public transport. All teenagers in Victoria, thanks to Helps, now get to ride the public bus network for free. Lisa Helps was re-elected to a second term in office late last year, and she spoke recently to Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis.
Before I was mayor, I was sat on city council, so I was there for one term as a councillor, and I had a great deal of frustration because people would come to the city with good ideas, and the answer was most often no, or all of the reasons why something couldn't happen. And I thought the job of mayor and the job of a city government should be to get to yes. How can we unleash the creativity and potential that our citizens and our businesses have? And so that's why I ran for mayor. It was a nail-biter of an election. It was me versus the incumbent versus a former Liberal cabinet minister versus a TV broadcaster journalist. So it was a tough race, a tough four-way race, but I squeaked through with 89 votes.
Your first term, you were pretty bold in the things that you sort of set in motion rhetorically and in practice from the get-go. You received quite a lot of opposition, I think it's fair to say, kind of at moments in that term for certain sort of ideas. Give us a quick sort of overview of that, if you could, and kind of how that felt, I suppose, being someone with energy and a vision for the city, and then suddenly things maybe go slightly awry.
I don't know how to quantify the opposition. The opposition is always loud and the support is always quiet. So there were, you know, some loud people saying they didn't like the bike lanes or they didn't like the initiatives we were taking on housing or they didn't like homelessness or any of those other things. How did it feel? It felt normal. Like, it feels like as elected officials, we have very different jobs than citizens. Citizens' jobs and businesses' jobs are to look after their dailiness, to take care of their family, to take care of their business. And that's also our job. But at the same time, our job is to look 30 years down the road. And so there's always going to be that tension. But I've, throughout my first term and into the second term, I'm holding fast to that long-term vision about what do we need to do now that's actually going to make life better now, even though in the midst of the construction of a bike lane or a new sidewalk, it might not feel like it. But what do we need to do that's going to make life better now, quantifiably better now, but also better for the long term? Holding on to that vision is I'm not going to waver.
The construction of the bike lanes, I believe, particularly were a sort of political topic, but also a talking point for lots of different parts of Victoria society. The bus drivers, I believe, particularly. Give us a quick snapshot of what that conversation was like and how, you know, when you are leading a city, how you keep the conversation going, you don't sort of back down, but you don't totally run roughshod over the people who are opposing you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The bike lanes are a really good example of a really important community conversation. And I think what we did at the beginning is didn't communicate very clearly. We had our first mandate, we had a strategic plan, we had a budget, and it was very clear that we were going to build a bike network. There was no question. But then when we went out to build the first, well, the first leg of it actually went well, but when we went to build the second leg, we didn't say, we're building a bike network. That's been decided. Now give us your input on this leg. And so there was some confusion. People, oh, you didn't consult us. Well, we did through the last election, and we got elected, and we're building this bike network. But I think what we could have said and what we're doing now is this is being built. There's no question about that. But how do you want this leg of the network to work? And, you know, I think we've done really good engagement on the next few legs. I mean, we're only like 4 kilometers into a 32-kilometer network. But I think the uproar has started to die down. People realize the network is being built. We learned here at the conference this morning that riding a bike is the happiest mode of transportation and also the most cost effective. I think that's what some of the earlier slides showed. But I think it's really a conversation about change and how do we change a city. And changing a city is hard, but if we're doing it for the right reasons, which is the long-term health and well-being of our residents, I think it's defensible change.
Talking about change, how in your mind is Victoria changing at the moment? You mentioned earlier that tech is the biggest sector at the moment in Victoria. What does that change look like sort of on the ground?
I think Victoria is becoming more of a global city. It's still a small city, but we're kind of becoming known around the globe for innovative approaches to 22nd century problems. And I say 22nd century problems because we're in the 21st century and really the decisions we make today are long-term problems. So I think we're becoming globally recognized as innovative, collaborative approaches to solving some of the problems facing cities. But also Victoria feels different. It feels different than it did 4 or 5 years ago. There are more people living in the downtown. There are more buildings in the downtown. There are more people out and about on a Tuesday night. You know, you used to walk down Tuesday night and I was quiet. And now there are, you know, restaurants are packed and it's busy. It's got a bustle.
You mentioned a little earlier the initiative to give free transport, public transport passes to children. Walk us through that if you could and what the motivation there was and what you hope the sort of impact will be when those children grow up, I guess.
The inspiration for that came from Kingston, Ontario, which starting in 2012 began phasing in free transit for youth, starting with grade 9 students. They're in a bit of a different situation because they have some provincial funding to support that. We didn't have any provincial funding. We only have our funding for transit. So we started charging for Sunday parking, and we're going to use that money to offset. Basically, we want to subsidize the behavior that we want to see, not subsidize the behavior we don't want to see. So parking should never be free. It is still free a lot of the time, but in this instance, it now costs to park on Sunday. And the idea is, just like when the Blue Box was introduced, the first place that the Blue Box inventors went was to the schools, and they said, here's a Blue Box, here's what you put in it. And the kids went home and told their parents, and then you have right there a next generation of recyclers. So too with transit. We hope that by empowering kids with their own transit pass, they'll take the bus, it'll feel like their transit system, and they'll become lifelong transit users.
And how bold a move did that feel when you look at, say, the grappling, I suppose, that other cities, maybe on a larger scale than, say, a city like Victoria? Does it feel like you're sort of blazing a bit of a trail with this?
Well, I think really Kingston, Ontario blazed the trail. We were the second to go down that trail. And I think it's interesting because Kingston has a different funding model than we have. Other cities will come up with different funding models. It does feel like a bold move. And what it's done, Victoria is a small city in a larger region. And so what it's done is started a regional conversation. What would it take to provide free transit to every kid living not only in the city, but also in the region? And of course, the kids, the youth, the young people outside of Victoria, they're like, what about us? And so I'm working with them and we're working with them to see what could it look like to provide region-wide free transit. And I think that will be a bold move if we can get there.
You are in your second term. What's in your sights to sort of get done before Election Day rolls around next time?
Really like to make sure that our climate leadership plan, which we adopted last summer, is well underway. Climate change is the biggest crisis facing us as a global community and certainly as cities. So I'd like to see some bold policy moves that can't be undone. Basically, my mandate before 2022 is irreversible change. I'm not running again, so I want to get everything done that basically can't just be undone when I leave office and if we don't have a successor who carries the same vision. So yeah, I think climate leadership, more housing, get the bike lane network done, and really set in place, and we're working on this as well, a measurement framework. So we know, are these investments that we're making actually improving people's health and well-being, both individually and population health? So that's a policy piece I'd like to see in place as well.
That was Victoria's Mayor Lisa Helps speaking to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis. Next, we head to the United States. The city of Clarkson in the southern state of Georgia is diminutive, to say the least. Just beyond Atlanta's city limits, Clarkson is a mere 2.6 square kilometers. But that hasn't stopped it from thinking big. Ever since the 1980 Refugee Act, so-called new Americans have been settling in the city. And while that has slowed down due to the Trump administration's clampdown on immigration, Clarkson has forged ahead with its mission to show what the future of the U.S. could look like. It's not just about refugees. Mayor Ted Terry, who receives an annual salary of $6,000 a year, meaning he has to have a second job, wants to welcome everyone while urbanizing the city, increasing the population, and making it a sustainable place that prioritizes pedestrian mobility over the car. He also wants to take his ideas further and recently announced he's running for the Senate in 2020. Monocle's America's editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, traveled to the Georgian city, bidding to become the most progressive in the South, to meet the mayor and some of Clarkson's other key players.
I'm standing next to a sign that reads Clarkston Village in large letters. Behind it, a row of shops with green roofs and a giant thrift town store, a pharmacy, a kind of typical scene, really, of small-town America, except when you look a little bit closer and just glancing around me, I can see people from all corners of the world, some of them in traditional dress, some are wearing head veils, and glancing more closely at some of the shops that lie beyond that sign in a sort of strip mall, I can see, let's see, Biryani Point restaurant. Also next to that, what seems to be a Vietnamese grocery store, an extremely diverse place. Hey, Mayor, how you doing?
Welcome to Clarkston.
Thank you.
My name is Mayor Ted Terry. I'm the mayor of the city of Clarkston, Georgia, known as the most ethnically diverse square mile in America. We're here at Refuge Coffee Truck, and we are in a town that is a vestige of the American South in terms of how the city has been constructed. We have a railroad that comes right through the middle of the city. You can hear it come through four times a day. And we used to be a railroad town, but now we are home and have hosted people from 40 different nationalities, 60 different languages. You can literally chart the course of human and world events over the last 35 plus years. People who have fled war, persecution, civil strife, and started their lives over in the United States of America here in Clarkston, Georgia. What you have is a community where you really can't have a white neighborhood, a black neighborhood, an ethnic enclave. The city geography is so small and so closely tied in together that everyone is neighbors. Everyone, their kids go to the same schools. We have, you know, a three-block area for our downtown. And so as a result, you know, the proximity to people that maybe aren't like you or where you grew up from is very present in the city. I think it also, you know, creates an atmosphere where ignorance really can't thrive. The reality is that when you're in a place like Clarkston, you're able to interact with people from all over the world, from different cultures, religions, language groups, you begin to get a glimpse of a future America that is more diverse. It just so happens that that diversity in this day and age in our political reality is that there is one political party that is more open to inclusion and diversity and another political party that is saying that it's a bad thing. And so I think as a result, Clarkson has become a lot more blue, more democratic because of the rhetoric coming from the Republican Party leaders.
The mayor's plans for tiny Clarkston are ambitious, including enlarging the population by integrating unincorporated neighboring areas and seeing through a $30 million infrastructure plan that prioritizes walking, biking, and green space over car culture. But can utopian Clarkston really influence the national discourse?
Clarkston is a small community, and we probably have received more attention regionally, statewide, and nationally and internationally more than, you know, a typical small city would. And I think part of that is that we have been willing to push forward innovations and bold policies that in a lot of ways are changing the systems of power in this country. I think that we are generally trying to look forward to the future and to say, here are things that we've been doing for years and years and years. This is the status quo, and it's not working for us.
I think you've said that you are on a mission to make Clarkston the most progressive city in the South. Tell me what else you have planned within that ambitious framework.
Well, in our quest to be forward-thinking and to be progressive and to really be proactive in solving the challenges of the 21st century, not only is it about welcoming immigrants and being more inclusive and compassionate, but it's also about tackling climate change. We are one of the few cities in Georgia to commit ourselves to 100% clean energy future, and we're also undertaking a very complex and systematic planning process to say, how do we get to 100% renewable clean energy and clean transportation? We are taking this idea of an urban agriculture city, a permaculture city, and taking it really to the next level where we want everything in Clarkston to be a closed loop system. We want to do citywide composting. We want to have as much food grown locally here. And we're changing our ordinances and laws to allow for greater flexibility and opportunity for people to be, you know, urban farmers. And then with housing, being the first city in Georgia to approve a tiny home neighborhood development, we're trying to reimagine housing. The housing of the 21st century cannot be sprawl-based. It cannot be homes on big lots. It's going to have to be a greater diversity of sizes for people who are retirees, people who are first-time homebuyers, people who are living at or below the poverty line, who just simply are spending way too much of their monthly income on just living and putting a roof over their heads.
Sat next to the mayor is his partner, Andrea Savone, a member of Clarkston City Council and very much in the weeds when it comes to solving the city's housing challenges.
So the challenge we currently face in Clarkston is how do we provide ownership opportunities for new Americans who are resettled here? What currently happens is they're resettled, they achieve self-sufficiency in about 180 days. They typically move within a year because there just aren't homes. I think when I looked at Neighborhood Nexus, which is a project by the Atlanta Regional Commission that track neighborhood data, neighborhood housing data, census data, job data, all of that, we had actually had only two single-family residential houses added to our stock between 2005 and 2010. So in our current stock, if you look at it, is very similar to what other housing areas are experiencing in that they're aging. 90% of the homes were built in the 1960s, 1970s. So it's an aging stock as well. So what we find is that people typically move, new Americans especially. They move to Gwinnett County, they move to Decatur, they move to a surrounding city and they purchase a home there. So that's kind of the problem or the challenge we have here is how do we create opportunities for them to stay here in Clarkston?
Can we get a picture with you?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, come on.
You want to get a photo of him?
Okay. Mayor Ted, as everyone calls him, may be popular with people seeking out photo ops, but Clarkston wouldn't be what it is without a tight-knit community of progressives, including Kitty Murray, co-founder and CEO of Refuge Coffee, the mayor's de facto office. A non-profit that partially sustains itself through shop sales and a catering arm, it gives work opportunities to refugees, all part of helping their integration. People like
Ali Muhammad, I'm from Sudan. I've been here in America for 2 years. I'm a barista at Refuge Coffee.
So what motivated Murray?
The reason for Refuge Coffee is kind of the convergence of three things. My husband and I moved here to Clarkston 7 years ago, and we knew it was a refugee community, but we didn't really know refugees. And so as we got to know our neighbors, I think, you know, I'm just a networker at heart, and when I meet someone I find interesting or enjoyable, I think of 10 people I want to introduce them to. So I immediately wanted the rest of my world to know this world. So that was one thing. Another is, until starting Refuge, I was a writer, and I work in coffee shops a lot. And I wanted a coffee shop nearby. I mean, honestly, that was just something I wanted. And then the other thing, as I got to know the community, it's a community of such talented, hardworking people, but the job situation here was rough. You know, most of the jobs that refugees were able to get are far away, low-level entry jobs, no matter what your skill level is or what your education is. And so I didn't think we could do much to move the needle on that, but I thought, wouldn't it be great if we created a coffee shop and a coffee business that in some ways could help employ our refugee neighbors.
Living like a refugee, it's not easy.
Proof, then, that Americans and new Americans can live side by side? Maybe Donald Trump should pay a visit. For Monocle in Clarkston, Georgia, I'm Ed Stocker.
To seek refuge in another man's land. You left your country to seek refuge in another man's land.
A report there by our America's Editor-at-Large, Ed Stocker. London's Greenwich Peninsula on the city's Docklands is an area of architectural outliers, from an underused cable car system to the massive Millennium Dome, a temporary venue which never actually came down. In short, this is a district of underperforming infrastructure. Enter The Tide, a new and free public space here featuring elevated walkways designed by the architects of New York's High Line, Diller, Scofidio and Renfro. Upon its opening last week, we dispatched our design editor, Nolan Giles, down to the site to see how The Tide, ambitiously applying some tricks the firm picked up in its home city of New York, might turn the fortunes of this area around.
You can't not draw comparisons between New York's famous elevated linear park, the High Line, and the new area of public space in London's Greenwich Peninsula, dubbed The Tide. And it's not just because they're designed by the same architecture firm. Elevated on an elaborately designed steel walkway and laden with freshly planted greenery, I was one of the first to set foot on what will eventually be 4 kilometres of public space featuring a network of these platforms. The broad aim here is to bring some life and apartment sales to this once desolate corner of London, now undergoing a rapid renewal from developer Night Dragon. Above the bustle of commuters using the nearby tube station and visitors to the area's music venue, the O2 Arena, the designer Ben Gilmartin told me how even in its earliest stages, The Tide provides a different perspective on this evolving London district.
I mean, I think we've learned from a lot of our projects in public space that we like these kind of spaces that create an invitation for people to gather collectively together, even if they're sort of acting individually. The space can support programs, actual performance or events on its own, but simply overlooking the square, watching people move back and forth is its own kind of engagement and stimulation. And so having this prospect is quite a nice moment to sort of be out of the surges of people, but to be taking pleasure from watching them move.
That's a really interesting point. People watching, it's something that we all kind of do. You've created a specific space for it. What is it, do you think, that makes that so interesting for people? Why do we want to sit and watch other people and kind of have a little bit of seclusion when we're doing it?
I don't know. It's hard to explain. There's something that's irreplaceable that is social about being out in the crowd, and when you're not part of the event that everybody else is going to, there's still pleasure to be taken from being amidst people, being immersed by them, and watching the flow of people come and go. It's quite appealing, and it's almost hard to explain the appeal, but it's a very natural appeal to most people. It's what draws people to the public realm, I think.
Cool, it'd be great if we can have a walk around and see a bit more. You were talking about elevation before, and walking along here, you get a very similar feeling to being on one of your other projects, the High Line. It's this height level that we're at, and the width as well of the walkway. Can you tell us about the decision to have it this high, why it needed to be this high, why we needed it to be this thin? What's the experience that you generate by designing it in this way?
Being at this height gives you a sense of elevation and slight remove from the ground plane below. The ground plane and the above work together, so there are islands below and islands above, and sort of it's conceived of as a landscape of many, many pathways. This kind of creates an overlook and a slight sense of remove, so a higher degree of intimacy and sort of individual meditative quality, I think.
Despite being surrounded by ongoing development, the mood atop the walkway tends to be relaxed and fairly tranquil, as wind rustles through the trees that are sat in humongous planter boxes placed along the way. The development's most impressive moment, however, lies at the platform's end, where a neatly landscaped seating area embraces a corner of London's mighty Thames River that few in the city get to enjoy.
The extension of the elevated path culminates in an overlook right over the river, which is, it's a bench, but it functions almost as a sunbathing deck. The pathway branches and further forks and descends to the riverfront Thames Walk level and goes north and south. And the pathway south crosses under the elevated structure to make this kind of beautiful sunken garden area. And between the two pathways, there's a stepped terracing down to the Thames Walk level that provides seating and garden space for a very pleasant individual experience of looking at the water.
The site hasn't even officially opened yet, and we've got, you know, people in their fitness gear having a run by the river. There's people here enjoying the views. There's a few loud workers over there having an afternoon beer. The space is already active. Can you tell us about how it feels to be standing here today and also what you expect to see when you come back here in 1 year's time?
Well, I think this is the seed of the kind of variety of experiences that we hope to see. But I think when we'll come back, there'll be cafe seating on the plaza and it'll be occupied by people sitting together or in small groups. The waterfront will be populated with bicyclists and runners and people taking a walk. And there'll be a lot of people hanging out and just processing their days or taking in the riverfront. And that'll be incredibly rewarding to see, the kind of theater of everyday life. And I think that we're incredibly interested in that, that everybody's sort of an actor and everybody's an audience, and that there's an incredible pull out into the public realm to be part of both watching and participating. And we're hopeful that the spaces that we make in the way that they define place creates the kind of stage and theater that draws people and makes them truly want to be part of that life.
A report there by Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist, which was edited by David Stevens. I'm Carlotta Ribello, and Andrew Tuck will be back next week. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's The Talking Heads with Cities. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.